This is a Renewed Covenant Ministry message. Every message delivered by this ministry strives to show the relevance of the most important covenant ever revealed to God's people, the New Covenant, a covenant offering grace through faith, thereby renewing the law of God in our hearts and minds through the manifestation of the only begotten Son and eternal Word of God, in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ, the Son of God and Son of Man, the firstborn among many brethren. The majority of our audio messages come from our Sabbath Bible studies, delivered by Brother J.S. Lowther at a Sabbath convocation centered around the patriarchal family structure near Marietta, Ohio. Contact us by mail at Box 134, 140 Gross Street, Marietta, Ohio, 45750. Find related messages relevant to the systematic theology offered by Renewed Covenant Ministry at renewedcovenantministry.com. And now for the message.
And so I just have a short kind of informational for study today. I'd rather sing and focus on Scripture, but it's a good time to remember the new moon in the Bible. And so I thought I would do something pretty simple that most of us are pretty familiar with, but there are a lot of people learning about these things who listen online particularly. Matter of fact, I'm kind of surprised at the amount of people that have an interest, who have gained an interest in the subject because of us talking about it and publishing That's How We Worship. So I thought that for their sake and for ours, because, well, we forget things, and that's just the way the mind works, I would go back over some of the concepts of the new moon in the Bible. The new moon in the Bible. And so I'm just going to start out with definitions that you may want to consider, which I already went through in discussing the new covenant and the correlation between the new covenant and the new moon. In the Hebrew, the word for new moon and the word for month in your King James Bible are virtually the same, and they are identical words. It's the word kodesh both times. If you looked in your Strong's Concordance, because that's what most people use, is a Strong's numbering system, regardless of what concordance they use. Young's uses the same, Thayer's, all those guys, they all use the same one. It is H2320, and it's kodesh, as I told you, kodesh or hodesh, depending on how you want to say that. And it is used 349 times in the Hebrew Scriptures. 349 times. It is not a light word. It's not a word that is, and that's just in reference to time. That's not using it in reference to general renewals. But it's not a small word. It's not something that's like little that you got to really pick through the Bible to find. It's there and available for us. The first time the lunar month, the kodesh, by the moon is referenced is in Genesis 7, verse 11. The very first time, it's definitely not the first time a man, an Adam, observed the moon or used it. It was obviously well established by the time of Noah, as what that verse says, is in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month or in the second kodesh, the second new moon, renewal of the moon. The 17th day of the month, that same day, were all the foundations of the great deep broken up and the windows of heaven were open. And so in this very second month, the second new moon, the flood occurred, of course, in the agricultural environment of the place of Noah. But nevertheless, that is something that can be remembered, that it was in this month that the Lord chose to destroy the world and purge it of wickedness and sin and save, more importantly, save Noah and his people so that he could make a better people with them, right? Well, that's not exactly what happened, but he preserved them so that he could make a covenant with them and a renewed covenant with them after that time. So it's something to remember that in this second new moon, you're also going to be able to remember that this was the time when the windows of heaven were opened and the foundations of the earth were broken to flood the world. Also, we know that the month or the new moon was definitely the divisions of the solar or agricultural year in the Bible because of various places that it's mentioned, but it's particularly because of those verses, those early verses, that we can understand that, that we can see that some form of renewal, some form of changing in reference, and we know what that is, it's not a hidden thing, in the Bible, is the way in which the year is divided up. And so in the King James Version, we have many places where you could just simply read the word new moon or new moons. New moon or new moons. One place that really helps us show, not as much in the King James as much as in other translations because of the way they translated certain words, is in 1 Samuel 20, verse 5. And I'm not going to, like I said, I'm not going to elaborate these particulars. I do have something to elaborate, but not at this time. And so you can go there and read, but I'm not going to elaborate the particulars on these verses. I'm just giving you them. You can have them. You can reference them. This is mainly so you can give an answer for why you do what you do. This is what this is about. And so that's why I chose to do this today. But in 1 Samuel chapter 20, you will see both in 5, verse 5, verse 18, and verse 24, and verse 34, all four of those, Jonathan and David are discussing the new moon, its duration, and David not being seated at the king's table for probably a sacrificial meal, because if you read in the law, you'll see how, especially in the prophets, this is explained that the prince or the king had portions that he was allowed to eat from certain things that he brought to the temple, and that was probably what was happening. And so long as you were clean, you and your local Levites and the people who were in your household would partake of these sacrificial meals. And so they're discussing going to be there, and they're also discussing at that time a two-day duration of the new moon. I would particularly say to check out the Bishop's Bible, if you've not looked at it, where the wording I think is the best in the Bishop's Bible when it talks about the second day of the new moon as opposed to the second day of the month. And that would be too complicated in the Hebrew, but that would be from 1 Samuel 20:34 in the way it reads in other translations. You can very plainly see that they celebrated the new moon 2 days like we did this particular new moon. And that was on account of the crescent moon not appearing yet. And so that's something that you can put in your notes for reference, 1 Samuel 20. There's also something very important that you can get just straight out of your King James if you're showing someone. You don't need any fancy Hebrew, even like I just described, to help show some connections. If you're looking 2 Kings 4:23, you would see where, and this is not the only time this happens, but you would see where the Sabbath and the new moon are mentioned side by side in the consultation of a prophet. So a woman is going, in this particular context, is going to go and talk to the prophet, and her husband says, "Why are you going to him? It is not the new moon or the Sabbath day." And she answers, "All will be well. All is well." And so it's obvious that people consulted with the prophets or heard a message from the prophet, heard something from the prophets at that time, and they would go to him during Sabbaths and new moons. And so we see an intimate connection between those there also. And so it's also all throughout Chronicles after the temple's built. It's in the law also. We'll get into that in just a moment. But all throughout Chronicles, 1 Chronicles 23:31, you could go to 1 Chronicles 23:31. We are told that there was offerings of burnt sacrifice unto Yahweh on the Sabbaths and in the new moons. And then it also lists the set feasts by number according to the order commanded unto them continually before Yahweh. So those are definitely commands of God to the people. 2 Chronicles 2:4 also mentions this, mentions the same thing, talking about the burnt offerings on the mornings and the evenings, on the Sabbaths and the new moons, on the solemn feasts of Yahweh. This is an ordinance forever to Israel. And so we are to bring our sacrifices of praise and prayers on the Sabbaths and the new moons. You can't logically hold the doctrine that says, well, we worship God in that way with our words in holy convocation to the Lord on the days God commanded, and then not do it in the way God had spoke of it in the past. So we know for certain that those were the times where people come together for sacrifice, for worship and offering unto the Lord. Also in 2 Chronicles 8:13, if you want to just keep making notes of these verses, you would see that even after a certain rate every day, the people offered according to the command of Moses on the Sabbath and the new moon. And so then all the feasts are listed as well. So you see it side by side all throughout the Bible. 2 Chronicles 31:3 says, he appointed also the king's portion. That's the part we were referring to in 1 Samuel 20, the king's portion of his substance for the burnt offerings, to wit, for the morning and evening burnt offering, the burnt offering for the Sabbaths and the new moons and the set feasts, as it is written in the law of Yahweh. So we see that that is where we would understand what was happening in 1 Samuel 20, where the king was having a special meal during the new moon. Of course, the psalm that we sang in entering into worship today was Psalm 81, 3. You would see, blow up the trumpet in the new moon in the appointed time of, or in the time appointed and on your solemn feast day. Now, this what this establishes is that the new moon is an appointed time, and it is a solemn feast day. So it is a time in which we are to have festival, so to speak. We are to worship the Lord, have convocation on it. In Ezra and Nehemiah's time, you also see that this was restored to the people of Yahweh. You will see it was restored to them when the temple was rebuilt in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah in Ezra 3:5, and in Nehemiah 10:33, you will both times read about the continual burnt offering, both of the new moons, plural, and of the set feasts of Yahweh, as were consecrated. And so you will see in Nehemiah, on the other hand, the same thing mentioned. And so that time, however, it says of the Sabbaths and of the new moons and of the set feasts, where once again you see that connection between the Sabbath and the new moon. Whereas in Ezra 3:5, only the word new moons and set feasts is used, and the word Sabbath is actually left out, which I think is something you should draw some attention to. In the prophets, once we get out of the history of Israel, we can start seeing the prophets. A common objection that people raise about, and this has been going on since the time of Justin Martyr, by the way, which is second century. So the first time we see a Christian oppose the new moon in worship is probably Justin Martyr, is probably the earliest one. He was obviously of a sect of Greco-Roman philosophers. He was definitely a philosopher. He wore a philosopher's gown. So he was heavily influenced by certain Gnostic concepts, meaning he spiritualized sections of God's law that should not have been spiritualized. And there was Christians that had done so. And so that was common during the second century. That is probably what led to the split between the churches of Asia or Asia Minor, Ephesus, and those churches, and the ones listed throughout the book of Revelation, where the Apostle John wrote to, the split between them and the Western churches was on the grounds of philosophy. It was on Aristotelian thought, so to speak. And the reason for those was basically, how much of the Bible are you going to spiritualize? How much of the law will you spiritualize? And so you will see this argument from Isaiah 1:13-14 arise very early in church history, and so you need to be aware of it. But if you read the context, it will be easy for you to detect that if you use this reasoning every time the prophets condemn an improper form of worship that is commanded by God, we would quickly not worship God at all, because men's sacrifices that were God ordained were condemned. Men's prayers that were not by a true and pure heart were condemned. And so in Isaiah 1:13-14, it says, bring no more vain oblations, so they're empty offerings. Incense is an abomination to me. The new moons and the Sabbaths, the calling of assemblies, your holy convocations, I cannot away with it. It is iniquity, even the solemn meetings. 14 says, your new moons and your appointed feasts my soul hates. They are a trouble to me. I am weary to bear them. And then he goes on to say, away with them. And so, like I said, very obviously, if you were consistent with understanding how the prophet rebukes Israel, you would very quickly see that men can't pray. Men can't do a lot of different things that God commands. Men shouldn't sing and worship. There's lots of ways men have abused Yahweh's worship. But what we see here is that the people were taking the Sabbaths, the new moons, and the feasts, the times of worship, and they're making them vain, something we've focused on last month quite a bit. And vain worship is always condemned by Yahweh because it is idolatry. And so one of the ways you can show that this is definitely the case in the life of the prophet is by taking someone from chapter 1 of Isaiah all the way to Isaiah 66:23, which then is the reconciliation or the renewal of pure worship. And it has dire consequences when people stand up and oppose it. So for those in the kingdom of heaven who say, I don't believe in new moons and Sabbaths anymore, you just have to keep reading to find out where they'll be, because no one will oppose the voice of the Lord when he speaks in Isaiah 66:23, when it says, it shall come to pass that from one new moon to another, from one Sabbath to another, all flesh shall come to worship before me, saith Yahweh. And so, as I said, continue reading and you will see why you will not oppose that command when Yahweh utters it. In the book of Ezekiel, we have a lot of references of new moon worship and restoration of that in the temple. In Ezekiel 45:17, we see the kingdom's restoration of the prince's part of the burnt offering that will be also on that new moon and the Sabbaths, the solemn solemnities of the house of Israel. And so we see Ezekiel referring to this again. We see Ezekiel in 46:1, Ezekiel 46:1, which is, of course, a verse I use very often to show how the Hebrew understanding of the month and the weeks were tied together as one concept. There were six working days, and then there was Sabbaths and new moons that were outside of the six working days. And so, very plainly, we read in Ezekiel 46:1, thus saith the Lord Yahweh, the gate of the inner court that looketh towards the east shall be shut the six working days, but on the Sabbath it shall be open. In the day of the new moon it shall be open. Also in verse 3 it says, likewise the people of the land shall worship at the door of this gate before Yahweh in the Sabbaths and in the new moons. If you were to continue reading, you would also see in 46:6 that, and in the day of the new moon, it shall be a young bullock without blemish, six lambs, rams, they shall be without blemish. And so you see the offering appointed at that time for the priests and the people, as it's spoken of. You also see a argument that will arise about new moon observation out of Hosea, also in church history, second century church history, third century, fourth, fifth century, to oppose quadadeciman use of the month. Quadadeciman is the terminology that was eventually used to describe people who worshipped on Passover by the moon and kept the Feast of Unleavened Bread, because quadadeciman literally means 14th of the moon. So quattro des men, and we will get into the word men a little bit here, but that's the word for moon in Greek. So 14th of the moon. They would use Hosea 2:11, where a very similar thing is spoken as Isaiah spoke. And it says, I will also cause all her mirth or happiness to cease, her feast days, her new moons, her Sabbaths, and all her solemn feasts. And so you will see God promising in the book of Hosea to punish the people for abusing his worship again. And it doesn't take you much to look at the context and see they were worshiping Baal on Yahweh's days of worship. So there was a little bit of, polytheism going on of some sort in Israel at that time. And God was condemning it. God was saying, I'm going to cause it all to cease because I am not worshiped alone, according to the first commandment. Amos 8:5 is a great verse to use out of the King James. Remember, all these that I'm giving you right now are just King James references. It's a great verse to use directly out of the King James to show that the people did not buy or sell on the new moon. Okay? So, the wicked of the land, and Amos 8:5, the wicked of the land say, When will the new moon be gone that we may sell corn, and the Sabbath that we may set forth wheat? And so the question of these wicked men of deceit are, when can we publicly defraud people? So these people are saying, we won't buy and sell on the Sabbath day. They're hypocrites. But when it's over, we're going to get out there and we're going to get to work defrauding people by deceit, because it tells us that they're going to make the ephah, which is a grain measurement, small, and they're going to make the shekel great, their silver great, and they will falsify balances on the working days. But don't worry, they won't do it on the Sabbath and on the new moon, lest they get caught publicly in transgression. Of course, you will see another objection, which I'm going to discuss at the end of this more readily, out of Colossians 2:16. Very commonly, you will see people use this to say Christians do not need to worship on special times as appointed by God. They can ignore the fourth commandment based on this verse, all the feasts, the new moons, and everything. It's very interesting because you often see many, many people who believe in the Sabbath understand this verse and forget the new moons even mentioned in the feast days. Like Seventh-day Adventists, for instance, who believe Saturday is the Sabbath, they will use this verse and they will properly render it to some extent, but then they totally kind of forget that whole new moon and feast day thing. And so Paul says, let no man therefore judge you in meat or in drink or in respect of a holy day or of the new moon or of the Sabbath days. Now, all I want to point out at this point right now is that Paul and the Christian church understood that Sabbaths, new moons, and feast days were something people worshiped on. Okay? And so, regardless of how you interpret that right now, that is a verse people will object to you with, but it is also a verse you can use to prove that new moons were kept. So if somebody says, well, the Jews or whoever, Israel never really kept new moons as anything special, you can take them to that verse and say, well, the Apostle Paul seemed to think so. So as is Sabbath, so is new moon. So when we start talking about the New Testament and the Septuagint, now the Septuagint is the Greek Bible of the Old Testament, okay? The Septuagint means the 70. It was because there were 70 elders or priests, some say, that helped translate from the Hebrew Bible into a comprehensive classical Greek form in Alexandria, Egypt. And so when we read the Septuagint, what we are doing is we are not taking it above the King James Hebrew. We're not taking it above the Hebrew context. We are looking at them side by side, and we want to know, how did the Hebrew people who translated the Septuagint understand this Hebrew term? And so that's what you use the Septuagint for. It's good for establishing doctrine. It gives you a second witness. It gives you kind of a different understanding on how you're dealing with a text. So when you're kind of in question, what's this mean in Hebrew, or what does this verse mean, you could get a whole different perspective, like looking at a shade of green from one angle closer to the window, and then it looks a little darker on the other side, but it's green. And so you kind of get an idea how that paint's going to look in a room or something like that. You could think of it this way. And so you look at the Septuagint to have a better understanding of a Hebrew concept. And so that's what we do there. One verse that is very good to consider, where the word new moon is translated right into the text, is in Exodus 40, verses 2, Exodus 40, verses 17. Those both do something that the Hebrew text says month. It says kodesh. The King James chose to translate that word month. But new moon is what the Septuagint says. Okay, this also occurs in Numbers 29:6, whenever it is commanding the offerings on the new moon. It doesn't say the beginning of your months, as the Hebrew says it, but rather it talks about how in those sacrifices it will happen during the new moon, so that there can be no confusion. It says, beside the whole burnt offerings for the new moon and their meat offerings and their drink offerings and so on and so forth. And so that's Numbers 29:6. This also, like I said, occurs in the law in Exodus 40, verse 2 and verse 17. And so the reason that is important is because this tells us without a shadow of a doubt that the new moon, the noumenia, that's the Greek for new moon, was the way the month was divided. There are people who oppose that, especially now. There are certain solar calendars that are becoming popular. It was actually in the time of Jesus, there was a whole group of what they were called Essenes and Zadokites and different people, different sects, who wanted to worship by a solar calendar that was more like what the Romans had, the Julian, or more like what the Egyptians had, which is still used by the Coptic Church to this day in Ethiopia and in parts of Egypt. And so they chose to use an Egyptian-based calendar and said, hey, Israel would have used an Egyptian calendar because they were in Egypt. And so they take the word Kodesh instead of translating it by the moon so that you have a consistency of sun, moon, and stars, and they place that into a solar division. You just divide the sun into a certain division. And I know about this because I actually observed it for a few years to see how it worked and quickly came to the conclusion this is not what the Bible is talking about, but actually, you know, watched it and saw how it worked. Also in the Septuagint in 2 Chronicles 29:17, you will find a place where you will read that there was a cleansing of the temple taking place on the first day, on the new moon, in the first month to purify, and on the eighth day, which would have been, of course, the Sabbath of the month, they entered into the temple of Yahweh for the first Sabbath of the month. And so it actually uses the word, translates the word new moon right into the text in the Septuagint. In Ezekiel 23:34, there's a place where you will not find in your King James, but will be found in your Septuagint if you have one, Brenton's particularly. Is where I went for this, where we read in Ezekiel, it's the same thing we read in Hosea, the same thing we read in Isaiah 1, where it says, I will take away her feasts and her new moons, for I have spoken it, saith Yahweh. Now the moon is still there and it's still working, so God was not talking about actually removing the new moon from the sky. God was talking about removing worship in the temple, worship by the new moon, that the people would forget how to worship him as he spoke it. Now, when we deal with the Septuagint, we also must deal with the Apocrypha to some extent. Now, we read from the Apocrypha. We accept it as a historical canon. We accept it as lesser scripture to the canons of scripture that have double witnesses of language and to the New Testament. So we wouldn't form any doctrine based off of the Apocrypha alone, but that could be said about a number of things. But nevertheless, the Apocrypha is something you cannot leave out in understanding the history of Israel and how people understood things. But the Apocrypha is written in Greek. It is not written in Hebrew. We do have some fragments now that we did not have in the 1500s of some of these texts in Hebrew. But for the most part, the Apocrypha is a book that is written in Greek, and so when we look at certain statements made in it, we'll distinguish it a little bit from the canon, but not a whole lot. The first verse I would point out is Judith 8:6, which just simply, regardless of if you think Judith is a real story, or it's not a real story, or it's just a symbolic story, whatever. Judith explains how the people of Israel would have understood how the Sabbaths and new moons worked. And so, regardless of how you think of it in fiction or nonfiction terminology, what we are told is that Judith fasted. She was a widow and she was sad. She fasted all the days of her widowhood, but she did not fast on the eves of the Sabbaths and the Sabbath days. So, as we have a special meal as we come into Sabbath oftentimes, she would break her fast on the eve of the Sabbath. And then it says on the eves of the new moons and on the new moons. Now that word is plural. And so Sabbaths and new moons. So this was her often custom to do, that she would break her fasting on the Sabbaths and on the new moons. And she would also not fast on the feasts and the solemn days of the house of Israel. And so this woman fasted 6 days out of the week. But on Sabbaths, new moons, and festival times, other than, of course, the Day of Atonement, she did not fast. And so that's important. We also know that new moon worship was established in the temple in the time of Jesus, in the time of Christ, because in 1 Maccabees, we are told in chapter 10, verse 34, that a particular ruler was going to do things for the people. This is probably in the Passover timeline, how we would see where Barabbas was supposed to be released, a prisoner was going to be released to the people before certain festivals and stuff. This is probably the origin of that. It may not be, but it looks like a likely candidate for some people. And I would say, yeah, definitely it does look that way. But 1 Maccabees 10:34 says, "Furthermore, I will that all the feasts and Sabbaths and new moons in solemn days and 3 days before the feast and 3 days after the feast shall be all of immunity and freedom for all the Jews in my realm." And then he goes on to say, "Also, no man shall have authority to meddle with or to molest any of them in any matter." And so maybe what arose out of this was setting forth one of your captives free in celebration of a festival and things like that. But what we know from this text for sure is that even the government respected the way the people worshiped on Sabbaths, new moons, solemn days, and feast days, so much so that they granted some form of immunity and freedom to all the people of Judah during these times, so they could travel and do what they wanted to do. Immunity means they wouldn't bother them or trouble them, and so that's kind of important to pay attention to. Now, when we talk about the moon and the month in Greek, it is obviously a different word that we're dealing with. The word for moon in Hebrew is Yerek. That's the literal moon, the disk in the sky. The thing you see in the sky is called the Yerek. But the Yerek goes through Kodesh, renewals. In Greek, you have a Selene, okay, which is the Greek word for moon, Selene. And the Selene goes through a men, which is where we get the word moon in English and the word month, men. Okay. And so in English, it's real simple. Our Anglo-Saxon British ancestors were way more, direct about the way they understood moons and months. We say month because month comes from the month, moon. And so a division of the moon is a month in Old English. And so that is not the case in Hebrew or Greek, however. We have one word for the object, and then we have one word for the changing of the object. One of the things that's most important to be, I think, noted, it also comes from the Apocrypha, is from Sirach 43, something we read, I think, several months ago now, where Sirach, who, if you read the beginning of the book of Sirach in the Apocrypha, he describes this book as originally written in Hebrew by my grandfather, and I translated it into Greek. And you lose something in translation, is what he says. If you go back and read the very beginning of this book, he says you'll lose in translation from any common, you know, regular tongue, common speaker of that tongue is going to understand it way better than a person once they translate it. And so in Sirach 43:5, it says, "Great is Yahweh," or "great is the Lord that made it," talking about the heavens, "at his commandment runs hastily. He made the moon," the Selene, that's the word, Selene, "also to serve in her seasons for a declaration of times and a sign of the world. From the moon is the sign of feasts, a light that decreaseth in her perfection. The month, the men, is called after her name." So it's not saying like we do in English. We could actually literally say this in English. The month is called after the moon. But that's not what he's saying. He's saying after the changing is the month named. And in Hebrew, this makes perfect sense. The month, or the men, is called after her name. So the Kodesh is after the name of her changing, increasing wonderfully in her changing, being an instrument of the armies above, shining in the firmaments of heaven. And so Sirach, the way he describes this, is that the month is named after the changing of the moon. Okay, the word month is actually named after that. And in Greek, this could sort of kind of make sense, but he tells us not to read it this way. But even in Greek, the word men is actually derived from another word called men. And it literally means to be faithful or to be assured, to be surely, something to be surely done. So it's something that is sure and firm is the real meaning of the word men. And so in talking about a new moon, there's one thing we can be certain of, like we read in the New Covenant, the pledge of the New Covenant, and that is that you always know the new moon's going to happen. Because God promises it will happen. It's sure, it's firm, it's faithful, it's always going to take place. And so the Greeks would have understood the moon in that way. However, the Hebrews understood it differently. They understood it from the concept of the changing of the moon, the renewal. A faithful renewal of the moon will always take place. It will always go through its courses. And so if you'd like to look into any of that, you can take a look at the word men in Greek, which is G3375, which talks about that strong affirmation. And your Strong's will actually show you, if you just look up the word for month in the New Testament, it'll actually give you a rundown of how to look at those root words and stuff like that. So it'll actually be a little easier if maybe you just go there and check it out. And so this should call something to our remembrance about Psalm 89. I don't know if you remember, but a few Sabbaths ago, a few months ago, we read Psalm 89, which was written by Ethan, the Ezraite. And Ethan, the Ezraite, he was a priest who helped write the book of Psalms for us. And when he writes of the faithfulness of God, he uses the moon as and the sun as an expression, just like we read in the New Covenant's pledge. It says in 1 through 5, I will sing of the mercies of Yahweh forever. With my mouth will I make known thy faithfulness to all generations. For I have said, mercy shall be built up forever. Thy faithfulness shalt thou establish in the very heavens. I have made a covenant with my chosen. I have swore unto David, my servant. Thy seed will I establish forever and build up thy throne to all generations. Selah. And the heavens shall praise thy wonders, O Yahweh, thy faithfulness also in the congregation of the saints. And so if we were to just skip down to verses 33 through 37, he's capping off his psalm, which I look forward to singing someday, that says, nevertheless, my loving kindness will I not utterly take away from him, from the son of David, nor suffer my faithfulness to fail. My covenant will I not break, nor alter the things that have gone out of my lips. Once have I swore by my holiness that I will not lie unto David. His seed, his son, shall endure forever. His throne as the sun before me, it shall be established forever as the moon, as a faithful witness in the heavens. Selah. And so you can very much see the concept of the renewal is not just the idea of a renewal in like a possible sense. It's possible the moon will renew next month, but it's a faithful sense. And the Greeks understood it in that same way, so much so that they caused the changing of the moon to be called sure. That is surely going to happen. The one thing that's always going to happen is the men. It is assured that the month is going to happen. And the month will change, the new moon will come. And so I find that to be very, very appropriate. Ancient people had a lot more to say about the new moon because they didn't have television, Facebook, internet, and distractions. They didn't have other distractions in their life. And as I heard one friend say that used to come here for Bible study, he said that was their television. They probably sat up on the rooftop and watched the stars and the moon change. And I said, well, maybe that's the case. I don't know. I'm sure they're more busy than that. But nevertheless, they definitely noticed things more than we do today. And that's a fact. We trust more in abstract knowledge. They trusted more in reality knowledge. And so that's important. So the last things I want to talk about in this just basic rundown is the unity of the new moon with the Sabbath and worship. I kind of touched on that already, and of course everyone here knows this already, how we see it. But there is a verse that I actually put a message together many years ago, maybe two or three, called Showbread Show Sabbath. And it was just based on some verses in the Bible where you can make these connections, and the showbread helped you kind of follow the breadcrumbs. Get it? Haha, Hansel and Gretel. Follow the breadcrumbs of the Sabbath. And so one of the places I like to take people to show the similarity between the new moon and the Sabbath, or at least the concept that the month and the week were linked in the way that Ezekiel 46:1 links them, is going back to Exodus 40, verse 2. I'm going to read it out of that Septuagint translation, just for clarity, just because it is makes it real plain. Exodus 40, verses 1 and 2 says, Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, on the first day of the first month, at the new moon, thou shalt set up the tabernacle of witnesses. And thou shalt place in it the ark of the testimony, shall cover the ark with the veil. Thou shalt bring in the table, and shall set forth that which is to be set forth on it. Thou shalt bring in the candlestick, and place its lamps on it. And so it goes on to tell us more about what's going to happen, but it explains the table of the showbread being set up on it. That's what the table is that's being referred to there. Now, if you were to also go to Leviticus chapter 24, which is the chapter right after the pattern of worship given in 23 that teaches us about how the Sabbath is a festival, and by Psalm 104:19, we understand it's a festival by the moon, but that's not what we're dwelling on today. You will see the contrast. So that when you view something from two different angles, as I had talked about it, you will see it in two different lights. And so in Leviticus chapter 24, it says, I'm going to go to 2 just to make, well, I'll just read from 5. Ye shall take fine flour and make it into 12 loaves. Each loaf shall be of 2/10 parts. And ye shall put them in 2 rows, each row containing 6 loaves. And on the pure table, that's the same table referred to in Exodus 40, a pure table before the Lord. And ye shall put on each row pure frankincense and salt. And these things shall be for the loaves for a memorial set forth before the Lord. On the Sabbath day, they shall be set forth before the Lord continually before the children of Israel for an everlasting covenant. And so if you were to take both angles and look at it in perspective, and this is by no means the only place to go to see this, you can read it other places in Exodus also, but you see that the table was set up and set forth by the priests that would do that in their course on the new moon in 40. But in Leviticus 24, it uses another word. It uses the word Sabbath. And so it's to be done on the Sabbaths. And so there was a way in which this bread was changed out every Sabbath. And we actually have example of that shortly after the new moon that occurred with Jonathan and David in 1 Samuel 20. So if you read in context, you'll actually read about this happening. And that is what I specified in remembering the new moon or showbread, show Sabbath, that when we looked at those verses. And so I would think that's an important verse to kind of connect it together. So if you want to talk to someone, say, well, give me one verse in the law. That's really common. You get one verse in the law that says that we are supposed to, that the new moon is a Sabbath, or the Sabbath and the new moon are connected. Well, that's a conceptual connection you can take them to. And by no means should we leave out Numbers 10:10. Numbers 10:10. Is one that we have dwelled on before. And in the Septuagint version, again, it says, new moon read directly into the text. It says, in the days of your gladness, in your feasts, and in your new moons, ye shall sound with the trumpets, which is why we did that today, at your whole burnt offerings, and at the sacrifices of your peace offerings, and there shall be a memorial or a remembrance before you, before your God. I am the Lord your God, or I am Yahweh your God. And I always like to point out that the word remembrance and the word memorial are the same as what you find in the fourth commandment. And so in the fourth commandment, it says what? remember the Sabbath day or memorialize the Sabbath day to keep it holy. There's a lot you could say about the Sabbath in general and the new moon from the scriptures. It doesn't take a really deep study to show the connection between them. If you're open-minded to it, even if you've never heard of it, and you just even want to use your King James, I mean, you can do it pretty readily. But using a Septuagint, a Brenton Septuagint, and a King James side by side, I think should turn enough stones over that you got to at least start scratching your head and wondering, how did ancient Israel understand this week and month as it was coming together? And so that's a good, I think that should give a lot of evidence and information for anybody who ever has to defend their reason for why they worship the way they do, or why they think that's the correct biblical calendar, or whatever the case is. It's important to show that. And so I want to deal just very briefly with Colossians 2:16, because this is going to be your number one objection. Even those people that I like, I enjoy them. They're good Christians and stuff like that. You know, I'm not taking my brotherhood from them or anything like that. I'm just saying this is the argument they'll generally throw at me. Even if they'll acknowledge, well, yeah, there was a different Sabbath for the Old Testament Israelites, but the church uses Sunday, and that's the Christian Sabbath, and they'll generally base it off this if they even believe in a Sabbath at all. And their argument is what Paul says here. I'm going to go back, and I'm going to read from 13, and then I want to tie it up and just ask you to think about what is said, because really what generally happens in these texts is that the context is totally abandoned by people who want to argue this point. It's totally abandoned. They don't argue the context. They just focus on a few words and say, this is good enough to tell me I don't need to worry about these things. But in 13 it says, "And you, being dead in your sins and the uncircumcision of your flesh, hath he quickened together with him, having forgiven you all trespasses." And let me just stop right there for a moment and make a point. Paul's dealing with Colossians. These are people who lived in Greek lands. They obviously did not get circumcised on the eighth day like they should have, according to the law and the practice of the fathers of Abraham and of Moses. And so Paul is saying, your uncircumcision of your flesh, God has quickened or made alive with Christ. And so, in other words, anything that could be held against you for not being circumcised, God has put that away at this time, and he has forgiven you regardless. He's not holding that against you. Okay? And so the context of what this is because you were dead in your sins, because you were raised in a family that does not circumcise, you're not in a covenant family, God still will quicken you, make you alive with him, and forgive you of your trespass. That's the context of what's being dealt with, forgiveness of sin. So then he goes out and he says, blotting out the handwriting of ordinances that was against us. Now, we all have a debt note, so to speak. That's what that's referring to. We all have a debt note. Everyone's committed sins, and God has a list of them. And so that debt note, where we can't pay for, because, well, we can't pay for sin, we have no ability to do it, Christ has paid for us on our behalf. And so all the debt that we have racked up that should condemn us and pay us in death, 100% total death, he has blotted out. Okay? He has canceled it so that it cannot be held against us. That which was contrary to us, he took it out of the way when he nailed it to his cross. And that is a symbolism, because in the ancient world, oftentimes when a debt note was canceled out, they would actually nail it to the doorpost or to a door to show that certain debt was canceled, that it was paid for, so that everybody knew that you weren't in debt anymore. You weren't going to be made a slave. And so it was public notice, in a sense. We did that in America at courthouses for, you know, it's actually kind of still going on. They post it in the paper now, but, you know, anyhow. It used to be nailed to the door. And so then he says, having spoiled principalities, that means government forces, principalities, the forces of government that are against you, that's not just in the world, but also in the heavens. He spoiled them. That means he robbed them of their power. He spoiled the principalities and powers. And then he made a show of them. He nailed that debt note up openly, and he triumphed over it like a victor who has got great spoil in war. He got gold, silver, and all this. He has all the ability to pay that he wants. And in this case, we're talking about the blood of Christ, which is so rich that it can pay for all the sins that he desires to pay for. And so then, directly after that, he says, let no man, therefore, because of this, let no man judge you in meat or in drink or in respect of a holy day or of the new moon or of the Sabbath days, which are a shadow of things to come, but the body is of Christ. So the body is the image, the very image. Those things were shadows of things that were to come. He's saying you were guilty of violating them. Someone could have judged you for all these, but you've been forgiven of not doing that. This is by no means saying go ahead and break that commandment if you want to. Don't worry about it now that you're a Christian. It's saying all the stuff that you had done prior that you've been forgiven for, God's not holding against you. He's paid for it. Jesus pays for it with his cross, with his blood. He triumphs over it. And he gives you a renewal. He gives you a new start. He gave you a new covenant. And so that new covenant says, I will forgive their sin and their iniquity. I'll remember them no more. And so what comes with that, though, according to what we read? I will put my law on your heart. I'll write it in your mind. I will be your God. You'll be my people. And so these are part of God's law, nevertheless. So Paul's not speaking these things to say, you know what, just forget all that stuff. Don't worry about it. No man's going to ever judge you for breaking the Sabbath in the future. The church you attend has no right to say to you, hey, we saw you breaking the Sabbath, the new moon, and the feast days, and, you know, all that. But you also have to realize that in the context of what Paul's thinking about is all that temple worship that came with it, too. So we're not just talking about Sabbath worship, I rest from my labors and I worship with my family and my friends. Okay? We're not just talking about new moon worship, I rest with my family and my friends. We're not just talking about feast worship at home or when we all get together in a conference or whatever. In Paul's mind, meat offerings and drink offerings are intrinsically connected. They're part of worship, just like all those verses in Chronicles we're dealing with. The burnt offerings of and so on. They were meat offerings, food offerings, drink offerings. Okay? These people, uncircumcised, could not bring those things to the temple. It was forbidden. It was forbidden. So you could honestly say that a person who had not brought his sacrifice, even if he wanted to claim the status of an Israelite, I was racially an Israelite or whatever he was still held judged because he doesn't bring his sacrifice, his meat and drink offering, to the Levite that then brings it to the temple on the Sabbaths and the new moon. So he was not, the memorial for him was not before the altar. So someone could rise up and say, well, you don't worship properly. You aren't circumcised, and we won't accept an uncircumcised person's offerings to bring them before the offering. It's unclean to us. Okay? What Paul's saying is that worship that was in the temple, Christ has even forgiven you of that. Christ's forgiveness goes as deep as your eighth day circumcision that got missed, that your parents didn't do. Now, that doesn't mean that a believer may not want to go get circumcised to fulfill the commandment. That does not mean that he doesn't want to start keeping the Sabbaths and the new moon. And during Paul's day, that does not mean, as we have evidence for, that does not mean that the people alive while the temple stood did not convert and send sacrifice to the temple, to the saints in Jerusalem. And that there was not Levites who were subject to Christ, because we have the book of Acts tells us plainly all that was the case. And so in Paul's day, this meant something different to us. But what it means to us, and the argument you will generally hear, is always going to say, you don't have to do any of that because you've been forgiven. Really what it's saying is you aren't guilty of any of that because you've been forgiven. It's not telling you that if the will of God says to worship on the Sabbaths, the new moons, and the feast days, that you worship on the Sabbaths, new moons, and feast days. That's the will of God. If it's the will of God, it should be on our heart and mind to do so. And so I just want to give you a quick apologetic on how to deal with that subject. I think you can probably make mincemeat pretty quick out of people on that if you just have a few of those verses to string together and show, hey, God said to worship like this. What's said here applies just as much about adultery. Let no man judge you if you used to be an adulterer, a fornicator, or a drunk. Says that in the Bible too. But are Christians then to say, hey, you know, Since we've been forgiven from adultery, fornication, and drunkenness, we can be that while we're Christians. No man can judge us. You see the point? And so the point is you can't claim forgiveness of some sins and say, we can't do them now that we're Christians, and then take that context and mix it up when Paul makes a statement. And so I think that that's important for us to meditate on and think of. Hopefully you guys, as you go through life and deal with people who may raise these objections, you'll be able to use these to help fortify why you do what you do and keep what you are doing as best you can. And that is why I put that together for us today. I hope it was helpful.
This is Holy News Covenant Ministry.